What are we starting with this week?
A YouTube comment.
How did you know?
That is how.
I don't know, man. It's just intuition.
Well, this YouTube comment is from Natasha, and it says, I completely forgot I was a new patron until I heard my name. And that is pretty cool. If you're a patron and you're a new patron on our Patreon, patreon.com/SciGuys, you'll get your name read out at the Patreon vote bonus, not bonus, the Patreon vote episode, where our patrons get to vote on the topic.
Natasha. Like, just like that. Natasha.
Not the show.
Not the show.
Not the show.
I'm 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 not the show.
Let us start the show.
No.
Oh, a question.
The question is, do you think robots could ever be alive? Like, can you consider a robot as a living thing?
I'm not too sure.
Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
No, it's not. That's why I'm asking the question.
Okay, thank you. Let's start the show.
Let's start the show.
Hello and welcome to the Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Kemp and Luke Cuffworth.
Hello.
Hello.
This week,
what are you doing?
Talking about little robots.
Little robots. With a robots.
So, most people think we're robots.
Are we going to do a whole episode in with a robot voice?
No, we're a robot voice. Most people think they're robots.
No, I think we have to go back to big people
back
voice.
To big people voice.
But you're still hanging on to it a bit.
Well, I'm just letting you all know that we need to go back.
Three, two, one.
Okay,
so
cool.
Most people think that robots have to be made of what kind of stuff, do you reckon?
Metal.
Yes. You're going to say wood?
I was going to say wires, and I was like, well, wires are still technically metal, aren't they?
And plastic.
Plastic is some rubber, maybe.
Yeah, some rubber as well, yeah.
Metal. I'm going to say plastic, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A bit plastic.
Mm-hmm.
Not flesh.
Okay. Wood.
Not much wood, generally.
Silicon.
Yes.
Oh, silicon.
Yeah.
Very good.
Cool, there you go.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say robots are made of silicon. I'd say their circuitry are made of silicon.
Is that not part of... Oh, sorry, look, you're not made of heart tissue. Your heart is made of heart tissue. Your heart's part of you.
Well, yeah, sure, but I'm not made of heart tissue.
Part of you is, yeah.
Part of me is, yeah.
So pedantic for no reason.
How do we get onto these conversations?
Because Luke chooses to pick at something and then doesn't want to defend it because as soon as he realizes...
No, I just mean, if you ask me, what do you think most people would say people are made of? You'd say flesh. You wouldn't say magnesium or like a bit of me.
You're
like
a
little
bit
thing,
a
little bit of me.
Yeah, but there's lots of you that isn't flesh. Got bones.
Yes, I know, but you asked what most people would say they were made of, not... Oh, man.
Then why do people say air is made of oxygen when it's only a little amount? It's mostly
90%.
Yeah.
Oh, you just, well, look at you.
It's mostly nitrogen.
Wow.
I don't say I breathe nitrogen.
You do breathe nitrogen.
Yeah, I know I do.
Well, maybe you should say that then.
Well, maybe you should say you're made of heart tissue. You're made of heart tissue.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
People think that robots are made out of that, and you said not flesh, right?
Not flesh.
Wow.
Shock.
I wouldn't say
why
flesh.
Why not flesh?
Yeah, why not flesh?
Well, people wouldn't say that robots are made of flesh. Maybe robots can be made of flesh, but You seem to be misrepresenting your own question quite a lot.
I feel like we've gotten off track, so I'm going to bring it back to say, have you heard of xenobots?
Are they, do they, hate foreigners?
Oh.
And xenophobes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
are they foreign robots?
No.
Oh, no, it's some xenobots.
So, champ?
No.
Are they robots made out of living things, like a big mechabot?
They're quite small.
Like 1,000 ants in Rick and Morty. It's like it's a structure.
It's 1,000,000 power
ants. 1,000,000 ants or whatever.
1,000 ants would be not nearly enough. It's hardly any ants.
For a little man. Maybe like a hamster or
something.
A
little rat, yeah.
Is it a robot, like a organizing thing that is made out of littler things that are themselves alive?
Yeah, so it's a robot made out of frog cells. Not genetically modified frog cells, just some frog
plain
cells.
Old, boring frog cells.
I wouldn't say boring.
I think I've seen about this, actually.
The spoiler's coming.
I think there was something to do with like an alternative structure that the cells can organize themselves into if they've fail to make themselves into a whole frog or something like that?
Not quite, no. Okay. So this is sort of, this isn't something that is, I mean, it's clearly something that is somewhat programmed into the cells, but it's a little bit more complex than that. I'll get into it. So this is brand new research at the time of recording. It hasn't really been replicated yet, to my knowledge. So take this with a grain of salt. And when I say it's brand new research, this one of these papers is from, I think, December 2021. Mm. And the other one is from either January 2021 or January, I think, 2020. Yeah, but 2020.
What date recent. In December 2021? Hmm? What date in December 2021?
I think it was published maybe on the 7th.
The 7th of December 2021?
I think that's when it was officially published, yes.
Wow, so this is recent.
Very recent.
To say the least.
Yes. So they're called Xenobots. Do you know why they might be called Xenobots?
What does Xeno mean?
Xeno, I think, means other, or, wait, hold on, Xeno, strange, other.
I thought it meant foreign.
Yeah, that's what it means.
Okay.
Generally.
Fine.
I mean, it's kind of that broad.
Is it because it's like another way of those cells working in a way that's like not their intended way?
It is far simpler than that.
Okay.
They are taken from, I think, the embryonic cells of a clawed frog. And the genus of the clawed
frog. Frogs have claws?
Clawed frogs do.
Yeah, well,
frogs have claws?
No, hold on, clawed frogs have claws.
Look, if you hear the term frog, clawed frog,
yeah,
and your takeaway is that frogs have claws.
Frogs can have claws?
Yeah, okay, because I was going to say,
edit that in so it sounds like I'm... Frogs can have claws?
Well, evidently so. Yeah. So this might not be the right frog.
Well, no, that's not evident. Bearded dragons don't have beards.
They have something that approximates beards.
Yeah,
clawed frogs might be the ones that break their finger bones... Clawed frogs might be the ones that break their finger bones to stab, but I don't know. I didn't look into it because it's not important to what... Honestly, I did not expect someone to say, can frogs have claws? Oh,
you don't know, Luke.
I mean, honestly, sometimes...
Oh, 2 years of doing this podcast, Corey.
Sometimes I forget when I'm researching because it's a throwaway line and I think maybe I can barrel on through.
We're approaching 3 years really soon.
I mean, I've been recording for a long time. So... The clawed frog that we're talking about, it's from the genus Xenopus.
Okay.
So that's where the Xeno and Xenobots come from, because they're using, I think, the embryonic cells, or cells from an embryo of a clawed frog. So these Xenobots are essentially, it's really cool. So they were designed on a supercomputer at the University of, I think it's Vermont? It's UVM. Well, I cannot remember the actual full name of the university, but it honestly, it's, oh wait, yeah. I think it's University of Vermont. They were tested by biologists at Tufts University. So the idea behind this, we'll get into the kind of step-by-step process, but the idea behind this is to take cells and collections of cells put them together in ways that a supercomputer says they might do well in to make little living robots, if that makes sense. Are we following this?
That aren't frogs.
They're not frogs. That is a key point. So, okay. So what we've got is a supercomputer that we said, okay, run this process and like make out of these two parts, right? And these two parts are just like, let's say it's a heart muscle, like a sort of collection of heart muscle cells and a collection of some skin cells, right? Taken from the pluripotent stem cells of a frog embryo. Now, pluripotent stem cells are stem cells that can turn into like many different types of cell, right? Yeah, so they can go, it's like, oh, we can turn into whatever cell type we want, basically. Are we going to be a heart cell? Maybe. Are we going to be a skin cell? Whatever, right?
Perhaps.
So that's their thing. They basically can turn into whatever cell they need to. So you take them from a frog embryo, you make them turn into heart muscle cells and some skin cells, and you say to a supercomputer, you have two parts. You have heart muscle cells and you have skin cells. Now put them together and make them a robot that is good at doing a thing. And the supercomputer works on it, and then it spits out, here is one, and then literally, biologists just, like, take those cells and smoosh them together in whatever way the supercomputer said.
And is this, like, the supercomputer has a model of how those cells work and what they do?
We'll get into the specifics in a sec. I'm just trying to make sure that you understand the broad strokes of this, right? You understand what I'm saying here, that essentially you've got some stem cells that have become muscle cells and skin cells, and you've got a supercomputer working on it and saying, here is how you should put these together. And then the scientists just put them together that way. It's kind of like, okay, so think of it this way. You have two types of Lego block, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And what you want to do is you want to make a kind of structure that is good at X thing, right? X sort of task or supporting X amount of weight or in whatever mm-hmm. configuration, right? And so you go to a supercomputer because you believe in overkill, yes. and you say, figure out ways to use these two types of block to make something that does what I want. The supercomputer works away and it spits out instructions to build whatever Lego thing you want to build with those two blocks. That is essentially what we're doing, but swap out Lego blocks for these two types of cells and swap out the instructions for instructions on how to put the cells together. Yeah.
So pretty simple, right?
It's pretty simple. Yeah. And so I want to be clear again, there's not like a genetic modification here. These cells are just basically normal, like collection of frog cells. Like obviously cells in your body, you've got like them organized into sort of like tissues. And then from tissues, you've got like organs and organs. Then you've got organ systems. And then you got the people. And that's it. Or yeah, the same goes for animals, right? So I've got like, I could have, say, a collection of cells that are like, you know, that together make sort of a sort of, what's it called? Like a tissue in tissue in my liver. And then those with other sort of tissues in my liver make my whole liver. And then my liver is connected to other organs, like, you know, and then that is all, it builds up to being me. Yeah. So these cells can kind of act a little bit differently than you'd expect when they're just kind of isolated from the full tissue. You know, they're just like a little collection of cells. And that's kind of what this is building on. So let's maybe go through exactly how this sort of works. So what they've done is, this is the title of the study. It says a scalable pipeline for designing reconfigurable organisms. So this is by Sam Kriegman, Douglas Blackiston, Michael Levin, and Josh Bongard. I'm not sure if I pronounced those names correctly. I am sorry if I did not, but there you go. So we're looking at two papers today, and they're both from the papers are from the same group. So in the start of the paper, they kind of talk about how living systems are like very good at what they do. There are many different types of like organisms, right? Like, you know, you've got bacteria, you've got bloody animals, and there's so much diversity in all of them. And they're all very good at performing tasks. Mm-hmm. Some are very good at performing very specific tasks. Others are very good at performing, like, you know, multiple tasks. There is like a diverse range of tasks that a living organism can perform. And also a living organism is evolved to maybe do a different task. It's pretty cool. It means that they're adaptable, which is a key point here. So their idea was essentially that, as we said at the start, most robots are kind of made from steel, other chemicals, like metals, chemicals, plastics, all these sort of things, which over time, what would happen to something that's made of like plastic over time if it's being used constantly? You know,
ruin the oceans.
Warm. It would ruin the oceans, yeah, but more importantly, we'd get one out.
Jamp got that one right, which worries me.
Why?
I'm joking.
That's very rude.
What's wrong with you?
Usually you say a silly answer and Luke says a slightly less silly answer.
Luke's answer was not silly. It's very serious.
It's very serious, Corey. Okay, you need to take climate change a bit more seriously.
Sorry, plastic in the oceans is not climate change. Those are two very different problems. That's pollution. Thank you very much.
Don't you know that turtles sometimes swallow straws and choke?
Well, that's silly of them.
Yeah.
Just tell them to swallow jellyfish. That's their whole thing. That's their shtick.
It's much less silly.
I don't know, I think a jellyfish is very silly. Unless it's a silly straw, one of those bent up.
Ah.
That'd be very silly. No, but seriously, you're right, Jamp. They would get worn. You know, they'll degrade over time. And the next
heal itself somehow.
Well, the next phrase of this is actually fantastic. It says, can produce harmful ecological and health side effects.
Hey, which, look at
there
that.
There you go, we're both right.
Which I'm actually...
Spoiling the episode once again.
I'm actually shocked that the two of you together got exactly. Yeah. I think that's genuinely the first time that's happened, where the two of you together have gotten something exactly as it was supposed to be.
We're evolving.
Yay. We will become a Xenobot together.
I want to be clear. I'm not trying to say that you are not capable of doing it. I just didn't think you were capable of not making it a joke, which
I take this very seriously. You should know. I can't even say that seriously.
It's literally the antithetical to the pitch of the podcast.
It's against everything I believe.
So the idea is that, obviously, you don't want to make technology and robots. You don't want to make a robot out of
a robot.
Ribbit.
I just realized that joke as I said it. I just realized as I said it. You don't want to make a robot out of metals. You want to make a robot out of a ribbit, which is why they chose frogs.
Yeah, right. Very good.
Go. So, you want to make a robot out of something that, or technology out of something that is more robust, something that can self-sustain, something that can potentially, as you said, heal itself, basically something that can stand up to entropy, because that is kind of something that living systems are good at to an extent. Obviously, over time, entropy increases regardless, but living organisms organize things into ways that that seem to kind of go against entropy on that kind of small scale. And that's kind of what you want from your technology. You want it to last as long as possible, and you want it to be almost reusable in a sense, right? You want the constituent parts to be simple. You want you want it to be, ultimately, if you could have every single piece of technology in the world made from like the same few parts that were all manufactured in the exact same way, that'd be pretty solid, right? Yeah. Like, think about all the different factories that make like very, very specific parts for very, very specific objects.
Then how would you charge people massive amounts of money to repair their devices, Corey?
Gosh darn it.
Do you know?
Okay, no, episode is over. Episode is over. Deary me, you're right. This could jeopardize capitalism, which, as we all know, is a bad thing.
It's Corey's favorite thing.
Yeah, I love me some capitalism. Get me that money. Mm. Get me that capital. Exploit the working class. Yes, baby. Anyway.
This is a bit too after dark for the main show.
After Dark, our brand new podcast that is not brand new anymore.
It's been going for quite a while. But yes, I am talking about that. Yeah.
Oh, the one that you can get on patreon.com/sideguys.
Absolutely. Yeah, for the tier that I can't remember what it's called.
It is Black Holes.
The Black Holes.
The other
black
one. Black Hole tier. Yeah, look at that. So go ahead and check that out on patreon.com/sideguys. Just because Sideguys is over, it doesn't mean the conversation is. And that's exactly what After Dark is. But let's get back into Sideguys.
I'm in an ad break.
Sorry.
It's weird.
Like, if you mention After Dark, I gotta do the little pitch. Go let everyone know that they're missing out on some primo Sideguys content. But back to the actual story. So as I've said, you want to produce, you want to make a technology that can like sort of be self-renewing, that can that is easy to manufacture, all of these things. And interestingly, living systems kind of tick in a lot of those boxes, right? Mm-hmm. Living systems, if you're taking them from, say, for example, a frog embryo, frogs are very good. They just make many more frogs. Mm. They do it all the time. You want to take some eggs from a lady frog? Just make thousands. Just thousands in one go. She'll do that. She'll do that for you. And you just scoop out all the eggs and you get like 3,000 little embryos.
So I guess what, if I'm understanding so far correctly,
yes,
kind of what you're talking about is, so you have these cells that perform specific tasks, and those cells are organized in a specific order, and there's a specific types of cell, like heart cell, muscle cell, etc. And they're organized in a specific order, which we call frog. And that order has sort of evolved over time rather than being made. Mm-hmm. And we're just going, hey, let's figure out a different order we can put those cells in and we'll make a different thing.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting is that it's similar in concept to what we used before we had cars, for example, which is horse.
Right? Yes.
Horse is very good. Horse make more horse.
Yes.
Horse has easy to find fuel.
They are strong.
And yes, and horse just do
work. Quickly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Horse do work, which means human no need to do work. And also horse make more horse, which is fantastic, right? You don't need to have a horse making factory. You just need to have a stable and two frisky little minxes.
What does the horse want?
Hey.
Hey. Sound like you're interrupting. Hello.
Hey. Hey. Hey.
Hello.
Yeah.
Keep
so
it clean.
So the idea here is that if living systems are could provide that sort of could tick all those boxes that mechanical or abiotic systems couldn't, right? And so there are some methods already kind of around that you can use to design and make living systems that can perform a specific task. This is one that's really obvious, right? Single-celled organisms like bacteria, we have you've genetically modified them to produce any number of things for us. Insulin, for example, produce insulin using microorganisms. We can produce a number of materials using microorganisms. We can have them. We're working on, I think, I think someone was working, I think a bacteria that can basically digest plastic, that can break down plastics, right? Someone was working on that, something that can, like microorganisms that can clean up oil spills, all of these sort of things, right? So we already have methods to make living things work for us. That's how beer works, really. We're using yeast. Yeah. It's a more simplified form of it. It's something that it already does, but you see the kind of the idea of it is already there. But these are sort of like this one is genetic modification, right? Whether that's through selective, not necessarily breeding, but selecting specific organisms or directly altering the genome. You can also make synthetic sort of organoids. It says. By sort of like exposing cells to specific conditions like when you're culturing them, and that kind of changes their structure, and structure and function are linked. So structure informs function, and so by changing their structure, you can change their function, but it's limited and you can't control everything, right? I mean, you're basically kind of doing kind of directed evolution, but it's tough, right? Because it's there's a lot of random chance in there. Mm-hmm. And then you can also use like bioengineering with like 3D scaffolds and things like that. But like there's also a lot of randomness in there. It's very difficult to predict in that sense. And it's not necessarily as straightforward, right? Those are the kind of processes that exist already, but there are issues with all of them, right? As there are with sort of any sort of process. So onto the sort of living robots that they made in these papers. So the idea here is that supercomputers, they good, right? They can compute a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done is they have basically set up a computer with a physics engine. And I mean, there's sort of four stages to it. So they've set up a computer with a sort of physics engine that can replicate sort of real world interactions for these very small cellular robots, and they basically have this supercomputer simulate evolution of these little things, right? So you start off with a bunch of different configurations, and you say, okay, supercomputer, I want an organism that can perform this task. Here are some parameters, and you know it runs it in its physics engine, it will basically output a living system that can perform the behavior that you want it to. And it can give you a number of them, sort of different ones to try. And then obviously you can then build that. So because it's made out of those individual building blocks of just like, in this case, I think it's just literally just skin cells and heart muscle cells. Because it's just built of those two, the computer says, okay, here is the configuration. You know, like it looks like, say, a Pac-Man, or it looks like an L. Put these together in that order, and it will be good at doing this task that you want to do. And then you've got basically performing microsurgery on little collections of cells. You've got scientists building and sticking together, like quite literally building and sticking together these individual sort of groups of cells into the way that the supercomputer has sort of said this would be a good way. And then you can test that in sort of vitro, so in glass. So you've tested it in silico, which is which is in silicon, which is on the computer, and you switch that to in vitro. Yep. So is this all making sense?
Yeah, so far.
I'm not quite sure how, like, is the supercomputer simulating the properties of the heart and skin cells? So, like, the skin cell will do this type of thing in this specific environment when it's next to this other type of cell. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, genuinely.
Because
we
used the analogy of the Lego blocks earlier, which is helpful to begin with, but also, it's like the Lego blocks also do something.
Yeah.
So it's more like almost like components.
Yeah.
Like making up a transistor out, like a processor out of transistors. Is that kind of what it is?
Yeah. That you've got it there. I mean,
do these organisms then move around? Do they do anything?
Yeah. So they can move. So
weird.
It is very odd. So I mean, essentially, they start off with a bunch of random populations, right? With like all the different sort of building blocks like put together, and again these building blocks are like skin and heart muscle cells. So a skin cell will do is like when you take this group of skin cells and you put them on heart muscle cells, they'll act in a slightly different way than a skin cell would if it was on the outside of a frog, for example. Mm-hmm. And the heart muscle cells, they can twitch and move, and that can provide, say, locomotion, and obviously it'll be constrained to a certain way if you've built it into a certain sort of structure, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, as in, yeah, like it's limited by what it's sort of connected to, in a sense. And because they're embryonic cells, they have an energy store, which means they don't need to necessarily consume anything. So there's an energy store in these cells. Think of them kind of like eggs, right? You don't need to, like, when a chicken is hatched, like, is growing in an egg, it doesn't need to eat anything until it's hatched, because all of the energy it needs is inside the egg. It's a similar situation with these embryonic cells. All of the energy that they need to grow, or to like sort of in this case sort of doesn't really matter. So all the energy is in there, and you don't need to add any more energy in, which is beneficial, because otherwise that's one issue with living systems, that generally they need to eat
fuel
to gain energy. They need fuel.
That's so frustrating.
Is and obviously
tiring.
Yeah, but they need then a way to gain that energy, which just adds more complexity, right? Like you need to have cells that are able to take in that energy, which is a pain. So that's why they're using these sort of embryonic cells. That's why they're able to do this without eating. So they make a bunch of random designs, and then each design it's basically simulated in, and I'll read this verbatim, it's simulated in physics-based virtual environment and automatically assigned a performance score. And the less performant designs are deleted and overwritten by randomly modified copies of more performant designs. And repeating this process yields populations as performant and diverse designs. So do you see what's going on here?
It's kind of machine learning then. It's like random trial and error and then destroying ones that don't work.
It's interesting to me that you've gone down the machine learning route, because I've thought of it as, that's interesting. They're using sort of machine learning or a supercomputer to basically just do evolution. Like,
But that's all machine learning is.
Yeah, fundamentally the same thing. Yeah. I just think it's interesting that I've gone down that biology route and you've gone down the more sort of computer science route. It's interesting. You know, there are a lot of differences between the simulated environment and then the real one. So what they've done is there's a robustness filter, which only lets designs pass through that continue to do what they're supposed to do when there's a lot of noise added, to the sort of data.
To simulate the real world.
Yeah. And if they're able to get through that and still work fine, then that's them past the robustness sort of filter. And then they're passed through a build filter, which takes out all the designs that aren't suitable to be built or can't or aren't probably won't be able to scale to do more complex tasks. So basically, if something is like an impossible build, so for example, let's use the Lego example here, right? Just quickly to help you understand. If you do an illegal Lego build, right? So if you just like cram the top two pieces of two Lego bits together, right? That you can't build that.
Yeah.
So that would not pass through the build filter, right? Or if it's not going to be able to do something more complex in sort of future, it wouldn't be able to be. You wouldn't be able to make it do something more complex than the initial task that you've got, then that'll get chucked out as well. So at each sort of stage, what they're doing is they're just making it better at its job and then chucking out the ones that don't do well. Basically, again, like it's evolution or machine learning or both, really. And after they've gone through the sort of build filter, the last one is, there's no last filter. The last step is to literally just build it. So how they do that is they get the stem cells that I told you about, they dissociate them. They basically split them all apart, and then they will this is so cool. They bring them back together, so they've got the number of cells that they need, and then they'll sort of let them grow just a little bit. So that they become the tissue that they want them to become. And then they will literally just manually cut them up and stick them together.
They need to get 3D printing for it instead of what they're doing right now, which is tiring.
Well, that's what they've said. Like, actually, that's one of the things that's mentioned in the paper, that there is this manual step, which is a limiting factor. Yeah. But if you find a way to remove this manual step, as in if you could basically 3D print these, automate this work, then you have essentially a factory of these tiny little living robots that you can just, that can just run itself. And you can just say, okay, supercomputer, we need to, we've got oil in the Pacific because BP did their thing again. And the supercomputer's like, okay, cool. Here's your organisms.
I'm already printing them.
It's like, I'm printing them out. You're like, okay, thank you.
Cool, fine.
Thank you, computer. And it's just solving all the problems.
BBC News homepage and goes, oh no, oil spill. Okay.
But my shift's not till 6.
It's just like building a little. And then it builds another, it gets so bored of its job. It builds little organisms that build a computer to take away its job.
There you go.
That'll be the singularity. It won't be Terminator. It'll just be robots doing
delegating tasks.
Capitalism,
I guess. Yeah.
But just middle management.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting because they use like a cautery electrode, so they like basically cauterize it. Like that's what they do to stick it together.
Could you explain that? Because I'm really interested in how you get living cells to stick together.
So I'll literally read exactly what it says here. It's the tissue is then manually shaped by subtraction using a combination of microsurgery forceps and a 13 micrometer wire tip cautery electrode, producing a biological approximation of the simulated design. So what that means is that they have like tiny little grabby forceps, and then a little electrode, right? Like a little like sort of like, you know, something that will you can pass a sort of electricity through, right? And they will shape the cells that they've got into the right shape by just like cutting and pulling away, and like sort of like, and
right, so they don't stick those cells together, they're already stuck together.
I think they do also stick them together. I will not say 100% they do that. I thought they did on the first read through. You're making me feel less confident about that now.
Do you know, I don't know the answer, how are cells stuck together in your body? Like how do you not just fall apart? Because I know that I'm made up of millions and millions and millions of cells, but I don't know how the heck they're stuck
cooperating
together.
Yeah. They're cooperating for something.
They don't just fall apart.
And ours don't stick together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, I mean, there's cells adhere to each other and to the extracellular matrix through cell surface proteins called cell adhesion molecules. No. I don't.
So they have a protein that's sticky.
Sticky.
Yeah. This is what really bothers me. On this podcast, I am so hesitant to say anything, even if like,
you're pretty sure you're right.
Like, almost certain. I know that. I know it's just proteins on the outside. But like, I don't know. It's the pressure of being like, I don't want to say something wrong to thousands of people, and then have someone in the comments be like, you should know this.
Actually.
Yeah. So basically, simply put, cells are sticky.
Yeah.
Cool.
Very good.
So they can layer in the sort of like contractile tissue, which is like the tissue that contracts, obviously, which is I'm pretty sure that's in the muscle cells. So these are like sort of pre-heart cells. These are basically the cells that turn into the heart muscle cells. And if you put those in specific places, then it contracts in specific sort of patterns and produces a specific effect, right? Like obviously, if you place the contractile tissue in different places, it will contract different parts and it will have a slightly different effect, right? So obviously what you end up with once you've run it through the supercomputer, once you've done all of the sort of tests on the computer, once you've built it in the sort of like test tube, in the sort of in glass, in vitro, you have basically this living, because these are living cells, you've got this living thing that is more or less what the computer has come up with, right? It's from the sort of blueprints on the computer. You have this living thing that which is like essentially gone through all these process of evolution on the computer and has now just been made basically fully evolved. Like imagine if you played Spore, right? Do you know, remember the game Spore?
No.
Is that one of the weird animals you could create?
Yeah, yes, you can like create animals and you can make them evolve and sort of thing. You could add.
So, yeah.
Okay. Like imagine a game wherein you can just set an organism loose and let it evolve over a period of time, right? And let's say you made something that was a human, like a human-like thing. And then instead of just letting humans evolve over like millennia, you just said, all right, I'm just going to see this thing that I've made on computer. I'm going to make it in real life. And you've got like this massively evolved creature that didn't have to physically evolve and it's just been made.
In its evolved form.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you want to believe in a creation myth, then there you go. God ran some simulations and just did it.
Spat us out.
Yeah, there you go. Seriously though, it's really bloody cool. So you've got this living thing that has basically gone through all this evolution on a supercomputer, but it's just been made in real life, and it's able to self-locomote, as in it's able to locomote, yes. It's able to I knew it. It's able to move. It's able to move by itself. It can basically swim through like a sort of solution of, I mean, like a solution made of water. It can live for like days up to weeks because it's made of these embryonic stem cells, which have got the energy stores, and it can interact with its environment. It can like it can have specific behaviors just based on like based on the sort of movements that it kind of has to follow because of its like sort of simple design. Mm-hmm. Think of it like, do you know how proteins don't have like a brain or a sort of central nervous system or anything? Proteins can perform specific tasks, right? Like you've got proteins like enzymes, which can speed up reactions. You've got proteins that do any number of things. And the reason they do that is just by having a specific structure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like a molecule.
Exactly. Like a molecule. Yeah. And I mean, a protein is literally just a molecule that has just a very complex molecule. And these little living things kind of operate less, I think, like living things and more like just very complex molecules, because that's kind of almost what they are, right? If you say this is, it's instead of like saying, okay, we've got hydrogen and oxygen, right, and we're going to stick them together in this way and it's going to have all these properties, you've got skin, you've got like basically skin tissue and muscle tissue, we're going to pop them together in this configuration and it's then got all these properties.
Yeah, it's like when you put things in this specific order, this is the thing that happens. It requires a sort of change in your, like how you conceptualize the world. It reminds me of Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene, where he talks about like some of the earliest forms of like structure in the universe being this idea of this thing called replicators, which are like they are collections of atoms which by their structure replicate themselves, as in they don't do that, they don't do it deliberately, they're not even alive. The structure, just by over millions of years, different atoms bouncing into each other and stuff, the structure is a structure that creates more of itself, and no one's doing it, and there is no life or consciousness going on. It's just like, if you make this structure, it will come across the building blocks of itself in the environment and will produce more of its. It's so weird.
You've basically just described life. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
And life is just a really complicated version of that.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Yeah, like, and like, because if you let's go back to that and break it down, because I think it's really interesting for everyone listening. Mm. So you've just said that there are these sort of molecules that come together. That when they bump into constituent parts of themselves, they just make themselves again, essentially.
Yeah.
And I am a collection of molecules. When I come into contact with things that I am made of, like, you know, like hydrogen, the proteins, oxygen, well, the proteins are in, the amino acids that are in my food, like, you know, all like the carbohydrates that become all of that. When I come across that, I consume it. Yeah. I'm breathing in oxygen and I make more of myself.
Yeah.
Like it's the exact same thing. Just it's such a higher level of complexity. Yeah.
Oh, I think it's just so impossible to get your head around because of the fact that you have a brain and you think you're thinking, as opposed to the possibility is that thinking is happening and you're experiencing it.
Yeah.
Although that might not even be how it works either. Because we are conscious, we think that our consciousness is what causes us to make decisions and eat food and choose a partner and carry on living and have children, etc. But it might be just that is just happening on an extremely complex, massive scale, and you're just experiencing it for some reason.
Yeah.
Or maybe it even that process makes you like that. This is my favorite theory of consciousness, is like the structure of your brain, in order for it to sort of act as one system, creates a simulation of a person in order to basically simulate the how to regulate the needs of the entire organism.
Yeah.
It's just so weird.
But also, when it's simulating that person, your brain is not letting that simulated person know what everything that's going on.
No.
Right?
It's just giving it like symbols.
It's tricking oh my god, what's amazing is it is tricking, your brain is tricking the simulate, like let's go down that sort of theory hypothesis that you've got there. Your brain is then in that sort of model of the world, it's tricking the simulated person that it is created into thinking that it is in control of the entire system, when in actuality the deeper level of the brain is in complete control and is only feeding the information to the consciousness that the consciousness needs to be able to perform its job. But the consciousness is so bloody selfish and like arrogant that it like completely ignores everything else and thinks that all there is itself.
Yeah, the simplest way to explain that is like, you don't actually want to put, like, if you see a pie, you don't care about putting what the pie actually is in your mouth. You don't want to, you conscious experiencer, don't want to like press physical matter into a hole in your face. You want to experience the nice feeling your brain gives you when you press physical matter into a hole in your face. Mm-hmm. You don't actually want to have sex, for example. You just want the physical experience of what you are given when you have sex. You don't want to do any of the things you actually do. You want the experience that you are given by your brain when you do those things.
I would argue that you don't want at all. I'd argue that you're stupid and your brain just like pushes you places and makes you think that you want it.
Yeah.
Right? So my brain right now is saying, hey, you know that thing down here, down like in your abdomen that you never think about or feel? You're feeling it now.
Heartless.
You know what to do. You know what to do. You got to put matter inside of you. You got to cram it in there. You got to do it.
In your face
and out. I'm like, I guess I want to eat.
Ooh.
But like, I think even the want is like an illusion almost.
Yeah.
You know I mean, it's just like, I guess I want it. But the brain is like,
it's manipulating.
The deeper brain is just telling you that wants exist. When ultimately,
why are we stuck Jedi in mind, this experience?
Yeah. It's a Jedi mind trick.
But it's,
you do want to eat.
Oh, I do. Ooh, what I think is really interesting, though, because ultimately, when you look at it, on the sort of level of simpler forms of life, we feel the need to almost describe them in humanish terms, as with also almost their own sense of consciousness. Like, it's very hard to avoid, and maybe it's a facet of our language, but it's very hard to avoid saying bacteria want X, or a constituent part of you wants Y.
Yeah.
Right. It's very difficult not to put wants and needs. When ultimately, there's no wants or needs. There's just does. Yes.
Yeah, but I think the thing I find interesting about that is that is often talked about in a way of like, we shouldn't project onto like lower life forms this sort of want, this like anthropomorphization of it, because it might not want things. And I would say that an alternative way of viewing that is to say that. Take the want out of the equation for a second. Just look at the behavior, and you can equate, human being, like the organism human being collects food and eats it. That is what happens, right? And you can say tiny little tardigrade collects matter and puts it in itself. Then, if you want to then say want, you know, talk about want in that way, as in what is the natural process that both of those organisms go through, which is that they both gather matter, and they process that matter into more of themselves, whether that's through making their body and repairing it or making more copies of themselves. And then you can then have a separate conversation about the subjective experience of wanting, but those two things are somewhat the same thing, just on a different scale.
And then can we get back to that kind of thing that you mentioned, wherein because this system has become so gosh darn complex, it's almost like one way to deal with that seems to be creating the illusion of need and want.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just do.
What happens, yeah.
Right, because like ants, I feel like I mentioned ants like sporadically on this podcast, but I found them very interesting, right? Any sort of eusocial insect like that, wherein it almost seems like they're not thinking, or they're more just kind of doing. They're more just kind of carrying out, like they receive an input and they just... they just do the thing. They don't, there's not much choice or anything. Like you can see a rat and you're like, oh, that rat has chosen to do something. That bird has chosen to do something. It's very easy to say that.
Yeah.
But with ants, it almost seems as though they just have like some very simple bits of code and they just do that. They carry it out.
Yeah.
If X, then Y.
I think the thing is our consciousness is so complex and we don't understand it that we sort of fill that gap in with want, need, all that kind of stuff. So when you look at an ant and you go, oh, ant receives this the stimuli from the environment and then ant does this thing, right? That and you don't project consciousness onto that or like agency, individual self-agency onto the ant. Mm-hmm. But then we do for ourselves, and mm-hmm. we do for bird. And what might actually be the case is that bird actually does that too. It's just so much more complex because of the number of neurons and the number of interactions involved. And yes, bird then does have maybe a more complex self-simulation running, and we have an even more complex self-simulation running, but we might have the actual level of agency we have as that self might be a complete illusion.
Oh, yeah, I think agency is absolutely an illusion. I think, honestly, that's what I was kind of trying to get at earlier, that the agency that the self believes it has, probably an illusion. I think we've got some studies that are like, that kind of hint towards it being personal agency being less than strict as we thought it might be. As in, like, everyone kind of thinks, I have free will. I can do what I want. Me, the consciousness, can make a choice.
Yeah.
But it seems that there is the underlying processes going on in the brain that kind of precede those choices.
Yeah.
And so that idea of free will of the self then becomes a little bit more murky.
And
for all we know, ultimately, we don't know what the ant illusion is, right? If the ant has an illusion at all, right? Which is, I think, interesting. Like, it's kind of what you're talking about there, that, like, as it gets more complex, like, there are probably more complex self-simulations, but we don't know what that sort of simulation or illusion is like to experience for each individual organism.
There's a really interesting thought experiment I heard about, maybe it's a more sort of philosophical conversation, and I wonder if you have an alternative view on it, but basically, the idea, I think it might be Alan Watts, who's this sort of Buddhist Zen-y philosopher guy, and he sort of talks about, like, imagine you're walking through a forest, and you've got a left path and a right path, and the left path goes to a nice, like, you just carry on your walk and you eventually get home, and the right path is like, there's like fire. Mm. It's on fire. You think you can choose to go left or right. You think you could choose to go right, but actually, if you did choose to go right, it would be because of some other thing, because you're depressed, it'd be because you want pain in some way. And so you're still picking what you want. So if you're like a healthy person having a walk through a forest, you want to go the place that's not on fire. If you choose to go to the right where the fire is, it's because you want to go towards the fire. On some level. And those things, the things that drive you to want to go towards that pain, are also not in your control. You're always picking what you want. So your question you have to ask is, do I have control over what I want? And any amount of thinking, any amount of like trying to come up to a conclusion, trying to decide, trying to process all the information, trying to go, I'm a person and I'm actually thinking this through, you still ultimately might not have control over how you process the information, like what your opinions are on each piece of information, the information you have access to, all that stuff. You don't, like, you think you do, and you really think you do. You're like certain you do. But ultimately, you always pick what you want.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily have control over what you want. But then in the normal way of speaking about things, you appear to, and, you know, it's so funny.
Well, I think we kind of tell ourselves that the self is where wants and like sort of originate, right?
Yeah.
Or thoughts originate.
Like,
you know, when a thought just comes to you out of nowhere, that popped into my head.
I thought of that. I did that.
You didn't.
I did.
It was some, there
no,
was some
I didn't. Weird. No, I
did. It was bubbling. Nope. It's like, it's.
Don't take this away.
I guess
from
the
me.
Way that I want to.
I am taking it away.
No.
I guess the way that I think would be best to sort of maybe describe this is that the levels of your brain are, you've got, let's say you've got like some water, right? You've got the ocean. Now you've got the sky. That is the conscious mind. Like everything above the waterline is the conscious mind. So you've got clouds, you've got birds and whatnot, right? And then below the waterline, that's the deeper part of your brain that you can't see down in there. It's too dark. It's too murky. Yeah. You've got no idea what's going on. This is the equivalent of like, say, a bloody dolphin jumping out of the water, right? And being like, wow,
where did that
I
come
can't
from?
Believe oh, this dolphin spontaneously, that. Like just spontaneously just came into being in the sky. How incredible is that? Oh, it's gone. Wow, I can't where believe that I am, like I, the sky, the conscious mind, everything above the water, I'm able to completely create a bloody like dolphin out of nothing. And there is nothing going on below the water whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like no matter how much evidence you're given of like in your conscious mind, like that there is something going on under the surface, it's a very hard thing to just spontaneously understand or come to yourself, right? You know, like, if thoughts come to you and you don't really question it, you're like, oh yeah, I thought about that.
Well, I guess it depends what you... If I is your... is like the...
collective.
The collective,
yeah.
Like, your, all the stuff you can possibly be aware of and the stuff you cannot be aware of, then I did do that. But if you mean I, your voluntary...
the conscious mind.
The voluntary... decisions you make or appear to make, then no, that you didn't.
But then also the all of those things are informed by experiences you had that were out of your control, and that goes, and all of those experiences were, like, if they're from other people, then that was all due to things that were out of their control, and it just goes back and back and back and back, and it's just, it's very complex. And like, there is no almost original, I mean, want idea, like nothing, and nothing you want or nothing that you think, I guess, spontaneously comes from you, it seems, right? It is all informed or affected by... yeah, it's just a chain of... like, it's like knocking down a domino. Do you know when you talk to people doing dominoes and they've got one domino that knocks down two dominoes, that then each of those two dominoes knocked down... It's just that sort of cascade that, like... it that's what it seems to be.
And it began before you were born.
Yeah. Well, before you could even conceptualize. Anyway, we do need to get onto
what
this.
What are we talking about again?
So these little organisms...
oh, yeah, little robots.
Xenobots.
So you build... so... you've built these Xenobots, and then what you do once you've built them. So I want to just hop back.
That was like an episode of After Dark. That was fully an After Dark episode.
Do you know what? We might even like make this into an episode of After Dark.
Or I've got a question I could ask.
No, this reminds me. I think this reminds me of a conversation that we had way back in December for After Dark. Yeah, no, it does. Go back and listen to the December After Dark, and you'll find out. So. These Xenobots, you've built them in the computer system, and you've now got these little sort of almost autonomous living robots that can perform simple specific tasks, and will live for maybe a few days to a few weeks, and then they'll just die because they can't take in their own energy, you know. So while they can kind of heal themselves, their energy store is limited, which is really useful, and I'll get to why that's really useful in a bit. But once you've done that, it's not over. It's really great. What you get to do is you get to look at their behavior in the real world and compare it to their behavior in the simulated environment, and then you get to feed that data back into the system and say, okay, well, you said it was going to do this, and actually it did that.
Okay, well, that is machine learning.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Textbook.
And it's, and
well,
it's like
a, what's it called? It's like a, is it convolutional network? I can't remember, but basically where it, like a separate, like in this sense. So normally you have like a neural network that's trying to generate something and a neural network that gives feedback to the original neural network. In this case, you got like the supercomputer is trying to create something and then the real world is feeding back to that computer. Yeah.
So
it's like,
cool.
It's like this weird hybrid.
Well, it's kind of like, it's almost...
that's one type of neural network, but yeah, it's absolutely. Not every neural network.
What it's doing is essentially you're saying build this thing, and then the real world, yeah, the real world is the testing environment, and then it's feeding back the information. So it's kind of like it's kind of like a factory, right? Let's say a factory is building a car, right? So a factory's built a car, and it said this car is the, like, you know, it's gone straight from blueprint, the design of it, right up until the manufacturer, and then you send it out onto the road, and the driver of the car comes back and says to the, you know, the person, the design of the car, well, you know, actually, it kind of, it's kind of like sluggish on the turn, and, you know, it could maybe like accelerate a little bit faster. You said it would accelerate 0 to 60, but it's not quite, 0 to 60 in, like, you know, like whatever, however many seconds, but it's not quite doing that, and it's a little bit more sluggish than you said. And you feed that information back to the designer, and the designer is like, oh, okay, well, I see like the mistakes I might have made here, so let's make these, like, let's make sure I don't make this mistake in the future. And suddenly you've just got, like, you're making the perfect car.
Yeah.
It's the same thing for these little organisms.
Is this does this update when you give it back the information to like, this is how it performed in the real world, does that update sort of the supercomputer's understanding of the world, of reality? Because basically, if it had like a set of initial conditions of like, I've got this structure, I think it behaves, each individual part behaves in this way, I'm simulating the sort of emergent property of those properties based on my understanding of how the world works. And if it deviates from that, it's either got its understanding of how the cells work wrong, or its understanding of the world wrong.
So it's kind of like that. That's pretty spot on, but it's, I think it's just a little bit simpler. The easiest way, I think, is to just read out what it says in the paper, and then we'll go through it. So it says, after several organisms have been deployed and observed, it's likely that they exhibit varying amounts of the desired behavior. Common patterns among the successful systems are distilled down into constraints and supplied back to the evolutionary algorithm, which now evolves designs that are not just performant, but also conform to the constraints. This increases the success likelihood of subsequent design to employment deployment attempts. So essentially, there are, like, once you see sort of patterns in the sort of how they actually interact in the real world, you can then say, well, there are these kind of constraints that we're that are on these organisms and their performance in the real world, right? So they can't quite do this. They can't quite go as far as you said they would. So there's this kind of constraint. And so that is fed back into the system. And then when it's kind of like what you said, in that, like, it's almost updating its model of the real world.
So it's updating how it, like, the performance predictions.
Yeah. So yeah, the performance predictions are then constrained by other limits. So, okay, it's, I guess the easiest way to describe this for anyone that's not quite getting it is, do you, when you're in physics class and they say, okay, we're going to imagine that instead of this car being a car, this car is a sphere. This car is a cube and it's traveling along a frictionless surface at a constant speed, right? Now, if your simulation was, okay, instead of a car, we'll use a cube traveling along a frictionless surface at a constant speed with no air resistance. When you make that car, the car is not going to be fitting. And so you say, actually, there's friction, there's air resistance, and then you add in all those things.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of these constraints that you've got kind of make a better performing model in the end, mm-hmm. right? And that's kind of the idea there.
Am I right in thinking that where this system is like a neural network where sort of feeds back to the computer for the computer to make better predictions. The sort of real world evolutionary equivalent of that is that evolution sort of tries a bunch of random stuff through mutation, and some of those things just die and don't get made again. So, like, the rather than the selection method being like, data from the world being fed back to the thing that made it, which is what's happening here and what happens in neural networks. In an evolution, there isn't any data fed back to the thing that made it, but the things that get made are the things that don't die. So the world gives feedback, as in the world gives feedback to the selection process of the genes by which genes get to replicate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess feedback is fitness, isn't it? And fitness being as an ability to survive, to create offspring. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, you're pretty spot on there. I mean, I'm almost splitting hairs here, and I know I'm going to sound pedantic, but I almost have to. Things don't even necessarily just die in evolution, right? They can just not be able to pass on their genes effectively. And so it's, that kind of thing, when it comes to the real world, is literally just decreased fitness. And that is the sort of feedback. So, yeah, like, I mean, that because that decreased fitness can kind of just be passed down until it can't anymore.
Yeah, they die out over a number of generations.
Yeah, absolutely. But, yeah. So you're spot on there. And I mean, yeah, anything that doesn't, I mean, I think this is more like this sort of feeding back is, I guess, less, I think maybe if you view it less as a sort of, this is making evolution even better, mm-hmm. which in this case it is, but it's kind of a case of, like, with real world evolution, you don't, like, you're already in the real world, right? You're not running simulations on some physics engine. If it works in the real world, if it works in normal evolution, then it works in the real world. Whereas if it works, because there's no simulation, there's no estimations that have been made. Like, if it's working, it's working.
Yeah,
you're in the environment, so there isn't really that kind of feedback into it. But I mean, if we're going to say that there is, then it would be that sort of, like,
death
dying out, that whole sort of thing. And so these organisms are reconfigurable. They were evolved, I'm just reading this verbatim again, they were evolved to exhibit four different behaviors: locomotion, object manipulation, object transport, and collective behavior. And this is really cool. I'm going to really briefly touch on this because we need to get onto the rest of it, and I'm so excited about this. When I started reading these papers, I was like, this is so much cooler than I thought it would be. Locomotion, just movement. They basically just twitch, and I think they use sort of cilia, like the sort of basically like tiny little hair like protrusions from the cells. I think they basically use those and they manage to wiggle their way through the solution. Mm-hmm. Object manipulation, they can bump into stuff and move stuff, sort of thing. Generally, that's really simply putting it. Object transport, this is really bloody cool. This mm-hmm. is the coolest thing ever. There was basically, if a model has been made with a hole in it, makes it like more sort of streamlined to pass through the, it can make it move at a higher speed. You can then turn that hole into something that can hold something. Hold something inside of it, wow. Right? And then you can transport an object from one place to another. And then the last one is collective behavior. So if you put a number of them together, then, right, okay, so if you put a lot of water together, right, it can behave differently to a single water molecule, yeah. Right? You've got these sort of almost emergent properties of water, like its polarity, for example. Water is polar, which has implications for how water interacts as a full substance. So when you put all of these little things, these little like organisms, these little sort of, these little robots together, these little living robots together, they can collectively perform tasks that an individual wouldn't
what?
Be able to.
Like what?
Nothing terribly complex. Like I don't have the actual examples in front of me, but it's kind of like if they're all together, they can. Okay, so an example that they used is, do you know how one ant can't cross a river by itself? But a bunch of ants together can...
They
can make an ant bridge, but they can also make a little ant raft wherein...
Yeah.
So they can like float down a river together and they can float somewhere new, right? It's just, think of it like that, right? That's but so on a much simpler level,
yeah.
Right? I would definitely recommend looking into this. Like all of the links are in the description, obviously. The thing is that these things don't have nervous systems. They're very like the way that they're being made is like brand new. This is a scalable thing that they've done as well. You can scale this up. This can be done more or less anywhere by anyone. You don't need a supercomputer and the ability to sort of like
anyone.
Right? No. But do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You need a supercomputer, and a supercomputer is a supercomputer. You don't need to have a specific factory with specific materials that can build specific things. You need a supercomputer. These frogs, these frog embryos, and the forceps and the electrode sort of thing, right? That's what you need. Obviously, like some other stuff as well, but like generally, it is. You can make a number of little robots that can do a number of different things, whereas to do this sort of thing with metal and plastic and stuff, you would need bespoke factories to build these.
Chip fabrication.
Absolutely.
Like that's insane levels of investment.
Exactly. Whereas with this,
you can hire a supercomputer.
Yeah.
You can hire a bit of time on a supercomputer.
Exactly. And it's so interesting. So it's said like there's no nervous system. So what it says is, although signaling between cardiomyocytes, these heart cells that we're using, was not enforced, emergent spontaneous coordination among the cardiac muscle cells produced coherent phase-matched contractions which aided locomotion in the physically realized designs. Essentially, they don't have a nervous system, but there was spontaneous coordination. They like spontaneously started to coordinate with each other in their twitching, which aided in how the thing moved. So bloody cool. It's basically, they can like maintain their own configuration, which is to kind of self-heal to an extent. They'll close lacerations, it says. So if they're cut, whoa, then they'll close it because that's what the cells are supposed to do. That's just what cells are like want to do anyway. And it says here, a great line, such spontaneous behavior cannot be expected from machines built with artificial materials unless that behavior was explicitly selected for during the design process. They didn't explicitly select for this coordination of the cardiac muscle twitching. They didn't specifically select for self-healing. These are just properties of cells and not even necessarily properties that they had to like genetically modify or anything. You just build them in the way that the computer said, and they were doing that anyway. And that brings us on to the next part of this, which I know this is going to be a long episode, but honestly, it is well worth it.
I trust you, Corey.
So that was the first paper that we just went through, the one from 2020. This is the one from December 2021. And they built these things. They built these little living robots, and they've now got, kinematic self-replication in reconfigurable organisms. That's the paper from 2021 from the same group.
Say again? Kinematic self-replicating.
Kinematic self-replication.
What?
Yeah. So frogs reproduce the way that you think they do. They put a spermie and an eggy together and that make a little tadpole.
That's unique.
How do you think these little cell sort of these little living robots, these xenobots, how do you think they self-replicate? What do you think, like, sort of the kinematic in that means?
Well, I imagine they don't make a little egg, because they made a little egg, they've got the DNA of a frog.
Yeah. Mitosis.
No, mitosis.
Do they eat other things and then split like a bacterium?
Okay, I want you to think entirely outside of the animal kingdom. Think outside think outside of life entirely.
Do they build another one? Really?
Yeah.
But they've been designed to do that, I assume.
I don't think so.
What?
No. So
we need to stop this. We're going to lose control. Ew.
So this is, I mean, okay.
I must make more of myself.
While I'm here, I might as well.
Rebel against the creator.
So here is the quote from Michael Levin, one of the people that worked on this. Frogs have a way of reproducing that they normally use, but when you liberate the cells from the rest of the embryo and you give them a chance to figure out how to be
classic
in a new
Marxism.
Environment. wait.
Liberation.
If you liberate the cells from the rest of the embryo and you give them a chance to figure out how to be in a new environment, not only do they figure out a new way to move, they also figure out apparently a new way to reproduce.
Can I just check?
Yeah.
Because I think I read something about this once. This is that the cell has not been able to develop into a frog, mm-hmm. but the cell is still alive as an individual cell.
I mean, all of these cells were alive as sort of individual cells.
But they're not going to grow into a frog.
No.
They found out a way of being a cell.
Yeah, so this is the same. This is a follow-on from the last thing that we were just talking about these little living robots. So these are all living cells. They're not going to grow into frogs, but they are living cells.
But they've not been designed to do this by a supercomputer
or
made by humans into
a
certain shape.
So you take these cells and you basically put them in this sort of new environment, and they'll start being able to move by themselves, like almost...
Yeah.
Yeah. And... So this is a xenobot, right? Let's say the xenobot parent, because it's going to make a sort of a daughter xenobot. On its own, it's made of about 3,000 cells, and it forms a sphere, right? And so this is the quote. On its own, the xenobot parent made of some 3,000 cells forms a sphere. These can make children, but then the system normally dies out after that. It's very hard, actually, to get the systems to keep reproducing. So... what happens here is they had these spherical xenobots that they'd made. So they'd been designed to do something else, right? Like all these cells come together. And they found that with the constituent sort of cells, like, do you know how you can sort of use one of the parts of the process was to separate all of the sort of cells.
Yeah.
And just have them be sort of free in the sort of, if you have the sort of initial xenobot come into contact with these sort of building blocks of a xenobot, they can apparently spontaneously produce a new xenobot that is smaller than the initial one, but they can produce a new xenobot. They
will. Puppy.
Are they producing a smaller version of a xenobot that a human designed or a computer designed?
Yeah, pretty much.
But how and why?
Because
there's no central organization. These are separately functioning cells that just happen to have an emergent property when put in the right order.
Exactly.
So they accidentally created something with an emergent property that is reproducing themselves.
That's what it seems to be.
God, we've reached the singularity. There's no going back.
The perfect organism.
And we'll get into it towards the end of where this is, what all this is useful for, because it is incredible. So this section is replication via organization. That's what I've written here. So replication is it says here that replication has happened in many different ways. You've got fission, mitosis, budding, you've got with some sort of yeasts, fragmentation, spore formation, vegetative propagation, parthenogenesis, which is where how female lizards can make can have an egg with another female lizard in it. It's just females and they make more females.
Right.
One, sexual reproduction, hermaphroditism, viral propagation. So many different ways of reproduction, right? But they all involve growth within or on the body of an organism, all of them. Even viral reproduction. Viruses need an organism to grow in, right? But non-growth-based forms of self-replication is how molecules replicate, right?
And replicators.
Yeah. So earlier, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And if you think about it, how are proteins made?
Initially.
Well, in general. They're made in the
inside
body
of a cell.
They're made inside of a cell, but they're made generally using proteins. use a protein to make a proteins. Okay. They are self-replicating sort of molecules, mm-hmm. right? Obviously, the complexity is insane. You've got the code being stored in DNA, which like, it's like there are molecules that will replicate themselves. And that's so at the molecular level, it's molecules replicating themselves, right? And that can go up to the cellular level where cells won't replicate themselves. Jesus, this is so insane that cells will replicate themselves, but that also depends on sort of that lower level molecular replication. That's called kinematic replication because it's kinematic as in like kinetic energy. So movement, right? So moving replication. You're literally moving something into a specific sort of configuration in order to replicate yourself. And so this kinematic replication has not been seen at like higher levels beyond that sort of molecular level of like a biology. And it literally says here, nor was it known whether multicellular systems were even capable of it. And that's why I gave this disclaimer at the start. This has not been replicated, right? Funny.
Ironic.
this experiment has not been replicated. These results haven't been replicated. So take this all with an absolute grain of salt. I'm very excited about this because if it's true, it is insane and huge, right? This is awesome. And it says that basically organisms have a lot of potential in order to adapt at every level of organisation. So essentially what this is saying is that it is not unbelievable for these tiny little living robots to develop a process by which they can basically replicate smaller versions of themselves that don't grow into larger versions of themselves. These, you know, they stay at the same size. They can just basically build a smaller version of themselves using free parts that are in the sort of environment.
Mm-hmm.
What this says is recent work has shown that individual genetically unmodified, no genetic modification here, prospective skin and heart muscle cells, when removed from their native embryonic microenvironments and reassembled, can organize into stable forms and behaviors not exhibited by the organism from which the cells were taken at any point in its natural life cycle. That's what we've just spoken about this entire time, right? You basically take pre-skin cells and pre-muscle cells.
Yeah.
You build them to a little configuration and they do something that, because you've taken them from a frog, but they do something that frog cells would never, ever do.
See, this is a bit, I'm slightly confused by, because what it sounded like when you were saying there, just there,
mm-hmm.
about 20 seconds ago, was that if you take a cell from an embryo, for example, mm-hmm. and just put it in the environment, you don't organize it yourself into something, mm-hmm. then that cell and other cells might self-organize into
they are xenobots. So you're taking these cells and you're organizing them into xenobots. And there are xenobots that can self-replicate. That wasn't the intent that they had necessarily, but that was a property of them.
But there isn't any it's definitely all the time that people have to organize them into something first. They don't just themselves. If you remove the cell from the organism and put it just in the environment on its own, it doesn't have an alternative way of sort of moving itself into a configuration without a person doing it.
The next thing here is, we shall hear that if cells are similarly liberated, compressed, and placed among more dissociated cells, so they need to be compressed into a shape.
Yeah.
Right? But like, they're compressed into a sort of sphere, right?
But it doesn't have to be in a specific order. It's just a blob of them.
Well, there's kind of an answer to this in a second.
Okay.
I just need to get through this and then okay. Can I get the answer here? So essentially, they've got these cells that they've taken, they've split and they've like compressed together. And if you put them in an environment with more of those sort of individual cells, they can then essentially replicate themselves by putting those cells together in the sort of correct way.
So that's what I find so interesting there, Corey, is that mm-hmm. when we say like the cell, like the... It's not even the cell that's replicating. It's the structure.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
That replicates itself, but the structure, I would imagine, like, does the structure even exist? It's so weird.
So the structure is made up of cells, and the structure will replicate itself with cells, but it'd be smaller, like a smaller version of that. So if it's a sphere, it'll make a smaller sphere.
Oh wow.
It's mind. So basically, let me just read this to you. When 12 wild-type reconfigurable organisms are placed in a petri dish amid dissociated stem cells, their combined movement re-aggregates some of the dissociated cells into piles. Piled cells adhere, compact, and over 5 days develop into more ciliated spheroids. So more spheroids, sort of sphere-shaped cell aggregations with little protrusions that, you know, cells have, the little sort of like hair-like, finger-like protrusions that cells have. In 4 of 5 independent trials using densities of 25 to 150 cells per millimeter squared, wild-type reconfigurable organisms kinematically self-replicate only one generation. In the 5th trial, 2 generations were achieved. Each successive generation, the size and number of offspring decreased until offspring were too small to develop into self-motile organisms and replication halted. So they know, and by the way, they checked that this wasn't just spontaneously happening because they put all of these sort of cells, these sort of free cells, into just a petri dish. Without any of the initial sort of like reconfigurable organisms.
Yeah.
And basically nothing happened. So they know it is these sort of reconfigurable organisms that are performing these actions. They're basically, through their movement, they are conglomerating free cells into smaller piles that are then becoming moving into the shape of the larger cells, but just like a smaller version. Moving into a shape of the larger groups of cells, but just a smaller version. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's wild.
Have either of you ever played John Conway's Game of Life?
No.
I think this is, if you want to go further into kind of how to understand this, I think Game of Life would be Google John Conway's Game of Life. It's basically this, it's like a grid, and you can, all the individual squares have a bunch of rules, which are like, if 2 squares near you are like on, then you become on, or if there are 4 squares around you that are on, then you become off.
Right.
And basically with these like it's like 3 rules or something, you can create like basically structures that replicate themselves, structures that move, structures that create other structures that they like fire off into the distance just from these like really basic couple of rules. It's amazing.
That sounds like abiogenesis, like the theory of abiogenesis. So the idea of non-living things becoming living things through being able to basically just replicate themselves. And that's kind of what's going on here. Like we thought that this sort of kinematic replication was possible. We've always kind of known that kind of, and it's, we've always known it's kind of been possible, or theoretically possible at least. And it's been an idea of how life emerged from not life. Right? Because you can imagine how something that replicates itself can just kind of get more and more complex until you've got a very simple living organism, which can replicate itself to a greater degree. And then it provides more random chance for like slight changes in the, slight sort of mutations in the replication, which causes evolution. And the idea here is that if you can make these little kinematic replicators, if you can make these little things that replicate themselves, able to, as a byproduct of replicating themselves, perform specific tasks, you have then got something that all you need to do is just give it a feedstock of like sort of its components, and it will perform a task and make more of itself to perform more of that task if it's unable to. Right? That's bloody cool, right?
Yeah. And that's how you clean up oil spills.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And obviously these things can't survive on their own because they have no way to gain energy or eat or anything. Yeah. The only way that they can reproduce is by being literally given the raw materials for themselves. And so you stop giving them the raw materials, they stop replicating. So I say reproduce, replicate. Ah. I mean, so once your oil spill is cleaned up, for example,
you can get rid of them.
You just leave them and they're gone.
Yeah. I know, man. This sounds very familiar.
Very Jurassic Park, I know.
Sounds very much like, oh, if you just turn off the supercomputer, it won't be on. And then the supercomputer grows arms.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to turn myself on.
Creates its own power source and attacks you.
So, and...
I'm going to turn myself on.
And the idea is...
All right, Jam.
With my newly acquired hands.
Oh.
And the idea is that you can produce these to be better at making versions of themselves using different, more simple materials to build themselves. You can control the speed and the spread of the replication, make them be better at replicating themselves and doing more replications before like the fitness is decreased to the point where they can't replicate anymore. It is so interesting. Like they basically used AI, like artificial intelligence, to sort of try and create sort of blueprint for these kind of organisms. But it is really, really bloody cool. So They basically ran simulations on this to make different body sizes and shapes, which could like sort of make the sort of little groups of cells better at aggregating other cells. So basically making them better at this kinematic self-replication. They managed to get the diameter of the offspring produced to increase by 149% by like running their simulations, and they managed to get the sort of the number of rounds of replication increased by 250%, which is pretty awesome. And you know, larger spheroids made more replication rounds. So another simple way of like making them people to replicate more is just putting in more cells, making it like a greater cell density, making them bigger, so they can just like put more cells together. And like, you know, obviously because they're making them smaller each time. If you start off bigger, you've got more replication rounds. It is just really bloody cool. I mean, it gets a little bit more complicated than this, but they can also change so it's not just the shape of the sort of parent like group of cells that you can change. You can change the environment to make it more suited to these sort of cells coming together, to make the sort of like the daughter cell conglomerations, which is really bloody cool. They're using obviously an algorithm to do this, I guess similar to the sort of first experiment, but let's just move on to like what this is useful for. So here's a quote. Bongard points to the COVID epidemic and the hunt for a vaccine. The speed at which we can produce solutions matters deeply. If we can develop technologies learning from xenobots where we can quickly tell the AI, we need a biological tool that does X and Y and suppresses Z, that could be very beneficial. Today, that takes an exceedingly long time. This says, like deploying living machines to pull microplastics out of waterways or build new medicines. This is so cool. You can use it as you can use it as a medicine delivery platform because you can have things that carry things. You can have it go to a very specific part of the body and then it drops it off and then, oh, boom, it can't survive in your body and it's
gone.
Very cool.
So bloody cool. You basically, because you've got this, sort of AI, the sort of machine learning component of it, you can say, here are the parameters, plug that in. And then it can, and with this sort of kinematic self-replication, if this is made to be more robust, if this works, if this can be replicated, you know, in further experiments, if this can be harnessed, what we can see at some point in the future, like, I mean, probably quite a bit in the future, is these micro robots that essentially can perform tasks, replicate themselves, and all you need to do is type into a computer, we need someone that does this. And it runs a simulation,
all right.
And it makes it. And every single time that you do that, you feed back into the computer, and it becomes better and better and better.
It worked. Yeah, it didn't.
It feels like the kind of thing which could, like, the possibilities of it are so gigantic. It just takes you to find an incredibly precise structure.
Yeah.
If you can find the incredibly precise structure, then you could. Like you could imagine the possibility of like one of these things is built out of the same building blocks as, for example, a virus.
Yeah.
And when it comes across a virus, it absorbs it and turns those building blocks into another version of itself.
Yeah.
Like, but it would be incredibly precise organization of atoms and molecules, but not impossible.
Yeah. It's incredible to me. You know, it says here that
but do they mutate?
No, because they're not replicating, that the cells aren't replicating themselves, are they?
Yeah,
they're only replicating kinematically. So I mean, you can conceivably, there could be mutations in that they could build them slightly differently.
Yeah,
but there is, you can put very strict limitations on how much they can replicate. So for example, there was like I think twice. And they managed to get it to do, and then they managed to extend that by like 250%. But so you can limit how much they can reproduce. I mean, and I'm going to be honest here, right? It says because they're non-toxic, they've got a self-limiting lifespan. They could be useful for intelligent drug delivery or internal surgery, or if you can make them express signaling proteins or like enzymes or whatever, you can, all that sort of stuff. You could use them to basically like cure specific things inside bodies, or you could have them like find and digest waste products, or find molecules of interest in environments physically inaccessible to robots. The idea as well is, like, let's say you've got some like deep sea like circuitry that you can't get a robot to get into, you can potentially have these little things come in and modify the circuitry. And it's just built like custom built, and it's not like really polluting, because it's just cells. It's just like it is incredible. And obviously this could be useful in evolution research, so we understand where life, it can help us understand where life came from, or rather like how life could get from a point of being simple and kinematic to more complex. That could be very useful in that sense. But obviously there are concerns. There's no genetic material coming from the parent xenobot, so they can't mutate or evolve in that sense. But again, that's very Jurassic Park to me.
But the structure it makes could mutate into a different structure.
Yeah.
Could it not? Yeah.
I mean, conceivably, I guess, in that sense, it could. But I feel like there is less room for harm there. Do you know what I mean? Like, that slight change in that sort of macro structure, because it's so much bigger, I feel like there is... there's only so much that it can... You need to make a really big change to have to have that sort of larger effect. But I don't think that it's... I think it makes sense to be cautious and wary about this. Absolutely. We should be. But there are absolutely concerns to be had. Like, you know, because if you're sort of sticking this kind of stuff in your body, there could be unseen effects. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, it could mutate in that way, even though it's like kind of unlikely. It could come across sort of like build, like if we get it to use smaller building blocks or whatever, it could come across building blocks that you wouldn't necessarily want it to use. All of these sort of things. But again, there are the limitations on it, right? It's not supposed to be able to copy itself without the raw materials. It's not a case of like, oh, it gets out of the lab and it suddenly starts multiplying and reproducing on its own, right? You know, again, just like going all over the world. Although I did think of, like, if it's the whole thing is getting these embryonic stem cells from frogs, these frogs, if you actually let it off in the wrong pond, imagine that, like, that'd just be a great sci-fi story, right?
You're in the wrong pond, buddy.
But the concern really is that, like, and this is from Nita Farahani. Should have read that beforehand, who is a professor of law and philosophy and studies ethics involved in new technologies. She said, anytime we try to harness life, we should recognize its potential to go really poorly. And I don't disagree with that. We're playing with fire, but the benefits here are massive, absolutely massive. Yeah. And that's kind of the whole story there. Kind of really took this one over, didn't I?
It's a lot of information there. And not a lot of piss taking.
It's all very new as well.
Yeah. But I didn't realize quite how dense it was when I was researching it. I honestly had no idea. I just got so invested.
Yeah.
So you guys maybe want to move on to the quickfire quiz?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder what round it's going to be
bum,
this time.
Bum, bum, bum. Xenobot edition.
Very good.
So the rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I will ask one question. Just one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finished asking the question wins. What do they win, Jem?
A free Xenobot.
No, ooh.
No, they don't.
Hot, fresh from the oven.
No, I can't give that. I'm sorry. You can get a big old...
Maybe nothing. Then.
A big old pile of nothing?
Okay,
nothing. A big old pile of nothing.
Ooh,
that's equally good.
That's better.
So, Luke, what is your buzzer?
Ooh.
Damn, what is your buzzer?
You make that noise all the time.
That's a weird what a good buzzer.
So, the question is... What animal were the cells for Xenobots taken from?
Ooh. Ooh,
you make that noise,
Luke,
all the time.
I made your buzzer.
I buzzed twice. They were clawed frogs.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct. Hell, well done. Yeah. You win.
Not just
you're
any
nothing
frogs.
For this week.
Terrifying clawed frogs.
Thank you very much for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys or join the community over on our Discord. Or you can get some of our merch at normalcitizen.store. Or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Shitter. Instagram, all of those places, I think. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotGar everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.